My name is Martha Buskirk, and I'm chairing the second session today, Ready-Made Product. I'm hoping that I will keep my voice through it, because like Dieter, I'm afraid I also am getting over a cold. So first of all, thank you. Thank you for the thought of bringing us all together and for the amazing organizational process that has put this conference together. Also, in the interest of time, I refer you to the program for all the affiliations of the people who are speaking in this session. So I'll just briefly introduce what we're up to today. The conference category that we are working under today is ready-made product, which gives us the opportunity to explore some intersections between artistic creation and questions of economy. Including the circumstances under which it's possible to claim authorship over everyday objects as well as experiences. And obviously one important facet of Duchamp's ready-mades is the way they set the stage for quite a wide range of artistic strategies that that engage with commodities, including branded products. They also focus attention on the potentially circuitous way that authorship is asserted and secured when a work is defined in conceptual terms. I will let Olaf Nikolai speak for himself when it comes to situating how his work relates to this theme in general, but in relation to his work, I've been particularly intrigued by how he has sort of played off of the framework of the ready-made to establish certain participatory situations. Including his outdoor garden installation of 25-meter running tracks based on the shapes established in Duchamp's three standard stoppages, or his enlargement of a Nike Air Max sneaker into an inflated sculpture. Gesine Tosan will address questions of collaboration, focusing particularly on the crucial role played by the alliance between Duchamp and Richard Hamilton. Tobias Folk will consider the significance of certificates and contracts in the work of a number of contemporary artists whose work is informed by conceptual practices. And I will start things off by exploring certain questions that I've been researching recently about the legal constraints on the play of reference operating both within and beyond the bounds of the contemporary art world. So you can start my PowerPoint. Okay. So in relation to my own current research, I'm particularly interested in what the art historical tradition of the ready-made can tell us about the larger economic importance of ownership over intangible phenomena, and how intellectual property conventions, copyright in particular, but also trademarks and patents, relate to the ever-expanding scope of conceptually based art practices. And what I'm showing you to start us off down this path is the awning for a steak restaurant opened in New York by former basketball player Michael Jordan in 1998. And I'm doing this not to provoke thoughts of where you might want to go for dinner later tonight, which you may already be thinking about, but for the letter forms employed by the steakhouse part of the text. This font was also used for a sitcom called The Single Guy, ran on US television in the 90s. And this text here is specifically rendered in P22's Duchamp font, initially designed in 1994 by Richard Kegler as part of his master's thesis on Duchamp. And he created it by appropriating individual letters from Duchamp's handwriting. And Kegler also went on to compose a Moreau font the same way. And I remember coming across this Duchamp font in a museum gift shop around that time for sale on a 3.5-inch floppy disk. And for those younger members of the audience here today, not only were there fewer fonts in general circulation at that point, but a floppy disk was a standard mode of transition if you acquired a font set. So the museum gift shop was the only strange part of this whole thing. According to a history of the Duchamp computer font posted on the P22 website at one point, Miró's grandson came across the Miró font in the Guggenheim gift shop in 1995 and turned the matter over to the Artists' Rights Association, a licensing agency that's the bête noire of all the art historians in the room. And they, ARS, demanded that P22 stop selling both the Miró and the Duchamp font. Since P22 wasn't prepared to spend any money on lawyers' fees, they complied, even though they were convinced that Duchamp's estate would have been sympathetic to the spirit of their gesture if they could only have gone to them directly instead of going through ARS. My second exhibit is more recent. This 3D printed recreation of a chess set that Duchamp carved by hand around 1918. The 3D computer modeling was realized by Scott Kildall and Brian Serra on the basis of archival photos of the chess pieces. And they posted their files on a site called Thingiverse. And their goal was twofold. To recreate an object that they believed, and incorrectly, in fact, to be lost, and to share the 3D files, printable files, as a free download. And there was a lot of interest. Multiple press accounts, along with at least 300 downloads. But less than 5 months after posting the files, they received a cease and desist letter from the Duchamp Estate's legal counsel, asserting the chess pieces as original works protected by French copyright law and demanding various remedies, including takedown from the file sharing site. Although Kildall and Serra believed they might have grounds for defense under U.S. copyright law, they complied because they, too, did not have the resources for a legal battle. There are a number of issues at play with these two examples. One is the duration of ownership rights established by copyright regimes, which have been repeatedly extended over the course of the last century or so. The standard now shared by many jurisdictions is the lifetime of the author plus 70 years, so 2038 for any of Duchamp's original creations. Another problem is the problem of needing to hire a lawyer to assert rights that one might potentially have. Now, I'm hardly alone in my criticism of this duration as excessive, and it's largely serves corporate interests rather than those of creators. But given the current landscape, the estate lawyers for the Duchamp estate could probably make a strong argument that the 3D chess piece recreations were part of what would be categorized in legal terms as derivative work. But I am far less clear about the justification for the ARS suppression of the Duchamp font. Some countries provide copyright protection for typeface designs, while others do not, based on arguments about utility, and the U.S. generally does not. But within the digital realm, the generation of fonts on your screens and printers via software code is subject to copyright protection. So Duchamp did not set out to create a typeface, so he did not make this as a typeface. And it appears to me that the transformation of fragments of his handwriting into a font was therefore entirely conceived and executed by Kegler. What these examples point to is the interplay, and I think in many cases the mismatch, between specific intellectual property claims and a widespread culture of appropriation and reference taking place both within and beyond the art world. And there are, as in so many areas, and here, as in so many areas, Duchamp was playfully prophetic. Duchamp appended an explicit claim of copyright to the end of his 1926 Anemic Cinema, in this context of this film, the concluding copyright statement appears where one would typically expect to find it. But the fact that the copyright notice is joined by two other marks of authorship or authentication a thumbprint and a signature in the name of Duchamp's alter ego can be read as a kind of ironic excess. A far more dubious copyright notice appeared 6 years earlier on his 1920 Fresh Widow. Specifically, the text you see on the right here is Fresh Widow, copyright Rose C'est la Vie, 1920. The object in question is a small-scale model of a standard French architectural element produced for Duchamp by a carpenter working according to his specifications. So therefore, in terms that we already discussed, very much not a ready-made. In her classic essay, Ready-Made Originals, The Duchamp Model, Molly Nesbitt considered how this work, along with various other ready-mades, and Duchamp's early images of coffee grinders can be linked to a late 19th century French initiative requiring primary school training in technical drawing, such that this language of industry was part of a shared repertoire that Nesbitt refers to as a ready-made base. The window design that became Fresh Widow in Duchamp's hands can be directly related to standard drawing exercises, according to this argument. And therefore, Nesbitt argues that Duchamp was claiming copyright for something not only plagiarized, but connected to an entirely different realm of intellectual property, an industrial good that might be eligible for patent protection if sufficiently innovative, but not a candidate for copyright. It's also amusing to for me to note in the context of the Sturtevant retrospective at MoMA in 2015 that the copyright notice clearly didn't do anything whatsoever to discourage Sturtevant from responding to the work with one of her repetitions, the term that she preferred to appropriation. So not only did she multiply this three-dimensional object, but she also multiplied the exact inscription on the object, serving to reinforce its futility as an apparent injunction against any acts of copying. It's also difficult to see how a copyright claim could be sustained in relation to one of the central aspects of Duchamp's claim to fame, his gesture of plucking a pre-existing object from the realm of the everyday. It is therefore, I think, very telling how hard Duchamp had to work in order to establish the frameworks within which these gestures would become meaningful. In relation to the blind man issue that we've already heard discussed, Thierry Dudouve has talked about his publication of Rejected Fountain as putting a message in the mail. The message in Dudouve's argument that anything could be called art, which he says did not arrive at its destination until the 1960s. Elena Filipovic's recent book, The Apparently Marginal Activities of Marcel Duchamp, really examines in detail the interval between these two poles, the initial gesture and eventual impact, paying close attention to the importance of framing and to the various curatorial operations that Duchamp undertook to establish these works as art, including, of course, the miniature museum known as the Box in the Valise, which was exactly one of these curatorial maneuvers, striking for the way that it intermixed replicas of work that did exist with miniatures of such objects as Fountain, which only appeared in reproduction at the time. Now, this is where my talk starts to seem like a ready-made, because so many things that are in my talk have already been presented here, just referencing the fact that most of the objects that we see as ready-mades in the museum at this point are actually specially made objects, substituting for the sculptural work, specially made sculptural work, substituting for the everyday objects. But even if it would be difficult to mount a legal argument for how the conceptual gesture of selecting an everyday object could be the basis for a copyright claim, There can be no doubt about Duchamp's success in establishing his ownership over the urinal in art historical terms, such that any artist's use of a urinal will be read in relation to his hold on the subject. And many artists have responded with forms of self-conscious reference. And I'm just showing you here the works that were included in a recent exhibition put together by Francis Naumann, where one of the really things that was striking was the fact that he included 29 different artists who made reference to the urinal, and the first thing you start noticing is how many artists were not on the list. Duchamp himself playfully acknowledged the power of this gesture at a time when it had just begun its full ascendance, with his 1961 talk at the Museum of Modern Art, the quote that Annette Tietenberg has already referenced about the ready-made and the tube of paint, and the idea that after this, all ready-made products, all paintings would have to be understood as aided ready-mades. I was reminded of this claim upon encountering Olaf Nicolai's 30 Farben, shown in an exhibition, Pantone Wall Instrumented, one of a series of works where he has referenced the specific realm of colors identified through a numerical system, first developed to help with print calibration, and now part of our digital universe. Although Pantone can't lay claim to the colors themselves, they have established proprietary rights over the system according to which they are articulated via their trademarked color guides. They also issue licenses to anyone who wants to claim to be operating in accordance with Pantone standards, or as they put it on their website, Pantone approved. And I haven't had a chance to ask Olaf if he has gotten one of these licenses to be Pantone approved. In the context of trademark usage, including trade dress, we don't actually appear to be facing a shortage of color options at this point. But I was interested to read about the depletion of words and phrases available to businesses attempting to establish trademark branding. Apparently, language is a finite resource, and at least for marketing purposes, a lot of the good bits have already been taken and claimed. Within the art world, there are obvious ways that copyright limitations have a direct impact on activities, including the dangers faced by artists engaged with strategies of appropriation, as well as controls, including overinterpretation, exercised by certain high-profile artists and their estates. But I also want, as my sort of final thoughts, to think about the issue in broader terms. A dystopian reading of Duchamp's attempts to lay claim to certain common or once common objects might lead us, for example, to the Internet of Things, sometimes referred to as the Internet of Things one doesn't own, based on the degree to which full possession is circumscribed by underlying limitations or access to proprietary software, as well as a lack of control over what happens to data that they collect. More broadly, it is interesting to consider how this particular, even peculiar, trajectory of artistic authorship can potentially help us think productively and critically about the network of ownership claims over the intangible that has been established through intellectual property laws central to many aspects of modern culture and economic life. Thank you.